In this week's World Vision Report, there's a giant hulk of a building in Liberia nicknamed Titanic. It's filled with former soldiers and their families who eat, work, and play together. We'll spend a day in the Titanic. And in Nepal, churning buffalo milk into ghee and moi. They're really delicious with popcorn. And our guide to world music takes us to Cuba.
This is, as they would say on the street, they're bigging up Cuba. They're praising their home country.
Around the world with the World Vision Report, I'm Diane Toomey. First, this hour's news. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Diane Toomey in for Peggy Wehmeyer. The trial of former Liberian President Charles Taylor resumed in The Hague last week. He's charged with committing war crimes during the conflict in Liberia and Sierra Leone in the 1990s. The war ended 6 years ago, but Taylor's former soldiers who were recruited or forced into his army are now trying to rebuild their broken lives. These days, in a more peaceful Liberia, several hundred of them live together in a massive building on the main road into Monrovia. It's known as the Titanic. Grant Fuller recently spent 24 hours as a Titanic squatter, sleeping in the building, eating with the residents, and playing with their kids. Here's Grant's story of a day in the life of the Titanic.
Emmanuel Flomo rolls out of bed and steps outside onto a spacious, private third-floor balcony with a sweeping ocean view. It sounds nice, but this is no luxury resort. Flomo is a squatter, and this abandoned building, nicknamed the Titanic for its imposing size, circular windows, and ocean liner shape, has been his home for the past 5 years.
It was just a vacant place. We decided to come and live here. We just live in peace.
Flomo perches himself on the concrete balcony ledge to brush his teeth in darkness. There's no running water or electricity here. But Flomo is one of the lucky ones. He's getting ready for work this morning. He scrapes by on $3 a day, doing construction labor on what, ironically, will be a luxury beachfront hotel.
I'm a 27 years of age man, and now I have not yet completed my high school because of the rate of poverty. Because my mother don't have money to send me to school, my father don't have money to send me to school. Personally now, no job in the country.
Like many residents here, Flomo fought with former President Charles Taylor's forces during the Liberian Civil War. It was the same war that forced a halt to construction of the Titanic, which was intended to become the new Ministry of Health. So when Taylor was ousted in 2003, the ex-fighters lost everything and moved in here out of desperation. Now, Flomo considers himself a victim of a senseless war.
But people grabbed me and put me into the war. I got used to the war. I fought the war. And then now I'm coming up to know how very much destructive war is. Because the same war is why got me to be sitting down here by now living in a government building.
He packs his bag with a change of clothes and heads out a rickety door as the building comes to life. Outside the front entrance, a young man and his buddies fiddle with a problematic tape deck and the tiny car he sometimes drives as a taxi. On the second floor terrace, a war widow serves pepper soup out of a huge pot. Rebels burned her house years ago, but today she's moved on, selling to men who are themselves ex-fighters. In the small open courtyard, a woman and her 10-year-old daughter are busy scrubbing their family's clothing against a washboard.
I love cleanness. Cleanness next to holiness.
With 8 children and an unemployed husband, the washboard is the only thing certain about this Mother's Day. Despite the hardship, the Titanic is an impressively organized community. Each of the 4 floors has its own leader who can approve or reject new residents. Augustus Tapa is chairman of the entire building. He was chosen because he was never a soldier, so the residents believe he's better suited to settling disputes.
You see, what we do normally is the environment, we talk to them.
You see, what we normally do is talk to people about keeping the building clean, and we make sure that if there's any conflict, we calm it down right here. I call all the floor leaders and I bring them together so we can solve the problem.
Tapas stations himself by a tiny closet in the lobby, which holds shelves of medicine, his own makeshift pharmacy for the building.
I have some painkillers. I have medication for worms. I have some vitamins.
To say that business is slow would be an understatement. But thankfully, the pharmacy is not Chairman Tapa's only business. Standing in the closet space, he flips through a flimsy school notebook and explains the names and numbers he scrawled into it.
So I got $100. He carried 3,000 LD.
This is his daily SUSU register. In Liberia, the daily SUSU is a small deposit you make into a savings account held by someone you trust. Many Liberians tend to keep their money under the mattress. But if you lack the discipline to save, the daily SUSU is for you. At the end of the month, Tapa keeps one day's deposit for himself as payment for keeping the money safe.
I call it a petty business, this little place that I'm hanging on by.
The name of Tapa's bank/pharmacy/chairman's office is painted on the concrete wall near the door. Better days, the sign says.
I gave it this name because there are better days ahead, and in the future I will make it bigger than this.
For others in the Titanic, the day rolls on with nothing to do. The concept of lunchtime is pretty much irrelevant here. Most people can only afford one simple evening meal of rice and soup. But the Titanic's early afternoon hours are filled with the sounds of children. With parents unable to pay their school fees, the kids of the Titanic are at home, running amok in their giant concrete playground. In an empty room at the end of the long third-floor hallway, some kids discover the fun of aluminum cans someone left behind. Near the stairwell, a little boy belts out his favorite song. Outside, four friends take turns sitting on squashed plastic jerry cans and pulling each other across the dirt by a rope. And on the top floor, a brother and sister chase around a small puppy dog.
Oh my kids, yeah. I got Matthew Martin. I got Martin.
Cooper Martin has seven children.
I got Guandao Martin. I got Connor Martin.
He sometimes teaches them in the top floor hallway. For lack of a better option, he's painted a solid black rectangle on the wall to serve as a blackboard. Martin says he was forced to join Charles Taylor's personal army and then was left with nothing when it was all over. He and many others still face discrimination because of the war.
So for us to get a job is hard.
For us to get a job, it's hard. Nobody will employ us. They say, those are Charles Taylor's people there. Myself, I went to school, but I stopped in the seventh grade. So the little I have learned, that's what I'm teaching my children.
Near the stairwell on the floor below, a circle of friends pass the time by playing a board game Liberians call Ludo.
Just to keep relax ourselves now. When there's nothing to do, just play, just to keep the day going.
Around 5 o'clock, a steady stream of people comes flowing back into the Titanic. Whether they spent the day breaking rocks, hauling sand, washing clothes, driving a taxi, or selling water, the Titanic's residents come home spent. After a long day at the construction site, Emmanuel Flomo grabs a towel and heads straight out towards the main road, bucket of water in hand.
I'm going to sit down in the darkness to the dark part of the area. That is a shower. It's not a bathroom. It's not any other area suitable for taking bath.
Meanwhile, it's dinner time inside the Titanic. For some, that means a heaping plate of rice with an oily cassava leaf sauce. But others will eat only plain rice tonight, or nibble on a piece of chicken or a handful of peanuts. Soon after dark, residents congregate in and around the only room in the building with generator power. Welcome to the Titanic's Video Club. 20 cents buys admission to three films shown on a small TV in a spacious ground floor room with straw mats covering the windows. The movie tonight is an old Chinese melodrama that has the whole audience gripped. The Little by Little Video Club, as it's called, was started by 24-year-old Darius Yunin.
Only me can make a play to be live today because everyone all are here.
I'm the one who keeps the building lively at night, Darius says. We have a big population here and no electricity, so people can be scared of us and say that we're bad people. I decided to make a video club here so everyone can come around and be together. Others skip the movie and use the time to get some much-needed sleep. Earlier today, Joseph Sio was paid to haul buckets of beach sand to be used for mixing cement. The hard labor has caught up to him.
Well, I'm resting now until tomorrow. Yeah, I'm tired now. Okay, but tomorrow before I will get back on my feet to hustle.
The day is also done for Emmanuel Flomo, the construction worker. Back in his Ocean View room after his outdoor bucket bath, he ducks under the mosquito net, lies down on a bed of wooden crates with a thin mattress, and begins to pray.
Dear Father, we are about to sleep in there, Father. We ask that, dear Lord, may you protect us and guard us from every other evil.
As he does so, he's ever mindful of how far he's come since his days of fighting in the war.
I'm very much grateful to God that now there is no war in Liberia, that now at least we are in peace. I tell you, thank you, worship you, the Father, forgive our sin. In Jesus' mighty name, we pray.
As the video club downstairs finally winds down and the clock nears midnight, the sound of the sea takes over again. And hundreds of Titanic squatters sleep another night in this hulking home that's not their own. For the World Vision Report, I'm Grant Fuller in Monrovia, Liberia.
Just 1 month after Grant embedded himself in the Titanic, all of the squatters were evicted by the Liberian government. The Ministry of Health says it's ready to complete construction and move into the building. Each Titanic family was given a minimum of $200 as compensation, and Grant tells us they left willingly. Today, the outside walls of the building have been painted white, and the Titanic once again stands empty. We've got lots of photos of the Titanic when it was still operating as a small city at our website, worldvisionreport.org. While Grant was in Liberia, he visited a couple of churches there. One was the large and well-appointed Providence Baptist Church in the capital, Monrovia. And this is the tiny worldwide mission church on the beach in the small village of Nyangba. The church has only about 12 members who all meet in a thatched roof hut with posters of Jesus on the wall. The sound of two very different churches in Liberia in that audio postcard from Grant Fuller. Cuban hip-hop group, the Orishas. Their music is a blend of rap and traditional Cuban rhythms. And you'll hear more if you stay tuned with us on the World Vision Report. Welcome back to the World Vision Report. I'm Diane Toomey, in for Peggy Waymire. We've got some Cuban rap and rhythm for you in about 10 minutes. But first, Nelson Mandela turned 91 last week. The former South African president had one request for his birthday. He asked the public to give 67 minutes of their time to help someone in need. Mandela spent 67 years of his life fighting for justice and equality in South Africa, 27 of them behind bars. Many South Africans responded to Mandela's call. Tarai Maduna went out and about in Johannesburg to see what people were doing on what's become known as Mandela Day.
In a message broadcast ahead of Mandela Day, the man it honors here this request on how to spend the day.
Our struggle for freedom and justice was a collective effort. Mandela Day is no different. It is in your hands to create a better world for all who live in it. Mandela Day will not be a holiday, but a day devoted to service.
And many South Africans took that to heart. The Johannesburg Festival Orchestra came to a community hall in Alexandra Township to perform a free concert for the community. Dozens of people join in and wave their hands when a famous song is performed. Kuhlwana Masote plays the cello in the orchestra.
The whole nation, I think, is today giving back to the good cause that all the values that Mr. Mandela stood for and still stands for. So this, for us, is how we decide to do it, is by using our skill and our talent to bring value to the people of Alex.
Masote said music was making a major contribution in bringing people together in a once-strife-torn country.
It's one of the tools where, you know, that can be used effectively in bridging gaps that have existed and that have been dividing this country for so long, because music is such a universal language, and what better instrument than the orchestra and its versatility of color, expressions, etc.
Near the community hall, young men and women are painting 82-year-old Martha Dlamini's house. Dlamini is a local hero. She is one of the women who took part in a groundbreaking anti-apartheid demonstration more than 50 years ago. Wusimate is one of the people with paintbrush in hand. She says community service is the best way to honor Mandela, known also to many here as Tata, which means father.
This is one way of saying to Tata that thank you so much for the struggle that you went through and for giving your life to all of us in South Africa, and this is the little that we can do towards celebrating his birthday. And obviously it's one in a lifetime that you get to 91, and this is our thank you to him.
Across town at the Moyo restaurant, hungry patrons could feast on dishes from a Madiba menu. Madiba is another affectionate term used for Mandela here. 20% of proceeds from the Madiba menu will be donated to selected charities. For example, there's the Grasha Michelle prawns named after Mandela's wife. Why prawns? When asked how his marriage would change his life, the then president said, "I have only two priorities in my life right now. Number one, my wife, and number two, eating prawns in Mozambique." Owner Mark Gold said he and his staff had spent the morning at a local hospital where they visited children and brought blankets and clothes that the restaurant had been collecting in the run-up to Mandela Day.
A day like today is a brilliant day to go and uplift their spirits and make their lives a little bit better, forget about any pains that they have, and, you know, just really put a smile on their faces and do something that's maybe a little bit special for them.
When asked what Mandela meant to him, he said no amount of words could describe Mandela.
I don't think you can sum up the amount of different attributes that Mandela has contributed to South Africa in building a nation and helping a nation and in healing a nation and getting people to walk hand in hand and join together in the communities throughout South Africa and, in fact, throughout the world.
But all was not harmonious here on Mandela Day. In the Jabulani section of Soweto Township, police arrested 67 suspects. The police inspector said his officers did not arrest 67 people to intentionally reach the auspicious number. It's a coincidence, he said. For the World Vision Report, I'm Tarai Maduna in Johannesburg, South Africa.
And just a note here, a few days after Mandela Day, rioting erupted in townships across South Africa. People were protesting against the chronic lack of housing and jobs for the millions who still live in desperate poverty, some 14 years after democracy came to the country. Turkey has had its own internal strife. Last week, a Turkish court ordered the excavation of an army base in southeast Turkey. Prosecutors hope to find the remains of 12 Kurdish men missing since 1994. Those men are just a few of the thousands of victims of the bloody conflict between Kurdish separatists and the Turkish state. At the height of the conflict in the 1980s and 90s, many people just disappeared. Human rights groups blame government security forces for most of the disappearances. Families trying to find missing loved ones have been met with a wall of silence from state authorities. Until now, Dorian Jones reports from southeast Turkey.
The sound of a country digging into one of the darkest chapters in its history. On land owned by a state oil company, a search is going on for the remains of people who disappeared. They were victims of a dirty war waged by the Turkish state against Kurdish separatists during the 1990s. For people living in the region, they are simply known as the disappeared. Most families of the disappeared, frightened and desperate, ended up in the region's largest city, Diyarbakır. Muleser Adıgüzel and her three children moved here from their village after her husband Vedetin, an activist in Kurdish politics, disappeared one wintry night 15 years ago.
Late one night there was banging on the door and shooting. Soldiers came in, blindfolded, and tied my husband and took him to another room. My children and I heard him screaming. Then they took him away. My family petitioned the courts to find him, but they said not to waste our time.
Adıgüzel, like so many others looking for their loved ones, ended up at Diyarbakır's Human Rights Association. For the last 15 years, the association has been working hard to find missing Kurds. Its office has been bombed and there have been numerous police raids. Muharrem Erbey is the head of the organization.
As far as we know, there are 1,500 people missing. But there might be far more, since many people were too frightened to report missing people. But now we're hearing from those families, because in our culture, it is so important to have a ceremony to bury your dead. Without it, these people live in a limbo, unable to move on. They are in permanent trauma, with a wound that doesn't heal.
Every week for the last decade, Adıgüzel and other families of the missing protest outside the office of the city's governor. Their efforts are now slowly reaping some rewards. An influential ruling party member in parliament is supporting their efforts. As a result, the government has now ordered the state authorities to start digging at possible burial sites across the southeast of the country. Nearly every day there is another TV report on the search for the missing. So far, the remains of 20 people have reportedly been found at one dig alone. Digging has also started at another site, an army football field, where more bodies are expected to be found. Each report brings hope for the Adıgüzel family that one of the bodies found will be Vedetin Adıgüzel. His daughter, Ayfe, is now 25, but was only 10 when her tortured father was dragged from their home in the middle of the night.
When we find my father, we'll be able to dig a grave for him in a cemetery, and he'll have a place in the world. We'll be able to visit him. It was so hard growing up not knowing where he is. When we see he has a grave, everything will change.
The remains of the bodies found undergo DNA testing to determine their identity. Meanwhile, police have detained 20 people in connection with the disappearances, offering more hope that further sites of the missing will be revealed. For the World Vision Report, I'm Dorian Jones in Diyarbakır, southeast Turkey.
Been a revolution in Cuba, but we're not talking politics, we're talking rap. Hip-hop music was shunned for a long time there, but now it's being embraced with enthusiasm, thanks in part to a group called the Orishas. It didn't hurt that the Cuban Ministry of Culture built a studio especially for these rappers. Still, the musicians ended up leaving Cuba. Now they're based in France. That's the music from the Cuban expat band, the Orishas. Our guide to all things music, Ish Mafundikwa, spoke with host Peggy Waymire about the band. Ish, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, Peggy. It's always fun being on the show.
And today we're going to talk about a band called the Orishas. They're Cuban, but they're not really living in Cuba. Where are they?
They're living in Europe. I think they started performing their music in Cuba, and then a couple of them moved to Paris as exchange students, and then they got together with other Cubans in exile and formed the Orishas.
And they've actually got a song about the difficulties of living as expatriates.
It's a song called 537 Cuba, and they paid tribute to their home country and also to Compay Segundo, one of the finest Cuban pianists who was also a member of the Buena Vista Social Club. And one of the verses talks about missing his homeland and his traditions and his friends that he grew up with, maybe never to see them again. Y que se pega y cuando llega no despega pega pega lo que puso el ruso en el discurso que Compay Segundo puso entre tus cejas ahora la distancia queda.
That sounds like they're mixing a little Latin flavor with rap.
Yes, exactly, that's what they're doing. Actually, that chorus is from Chan Chan, which was on the album, the Buena Vista Social Club, that huge album of theirs of a few years ago.
Hmm.
So they are mixing both Latin sounds and hip-hop.
Now, how popular is this music in Europe? It's interesting that they live in Paris and they're playing this Cuban Latin rap music. How does the audience in Europe respond to them?
It is very popular, especially in France and Spain, obviously because they live there, and I guess they get to do a lot of live gigs. And of course, Spain, I'm sure they understand the language as well. So, yeah, it is pretty big.
I'm just wondering how much of their sound is traditionally Cuban and what else they add to it.
Well, like rap everywhere, I think it's a fusion of different sounds. And initially, I think they just started with beats like they do in the United States, straight ahead hip-hop. But when they moved to Europe, that's when they started mixing traditional Cuban sounds. And that did cause quite a bit of a controversy where some people were saying, well, you know, you shouldn't be doing that. You should leave that traditional stuff alone. But, you know, I think what they're trying to do is to appeal to the audience back home, the audience in Europe, and also trying to emphasize where they're coming from.
Is there a song we can hear where we'd get a feel for the traditional Cuban flavor of their music?
Yeah, I think maybe we could listen to Silencio. El hermano de la calle es el problema social. Ahora mismo puede arrastrar. Estoy parado frente a la tropa de nuevo y no juego. Hay que acabar con esto antes de que corra el fuego. Dolorosa.
Ish, the Orishas also write lyrics about social issues, racism being one of them. How much is racism talked about openly in Cuba?
What I know is that, you know, Cuba tries to present this picture of being a colorless society where black, white, and everybody else lives happily together. But the Orishas, in their music, they started addressing the social issues of being black in Cuba. And I think the strongest statement they started off with is their name.
Mm-hmm.
Orishas is actually a set of gods worshipped by African-based religions. They picked up on that name to emphasize their connections with Africa.
And I guess the blacks in Cuba come from the African slaves who were introduced into Cuba from Spain in the 16th century?
Yeah, they were actually brought from the African mainland, from West Africa mostly, to Cuba to work in the sugarcane field.
And so they sing about this racism as a social justice issue, but they also write about other social issues. What other issues are they tackling in their music?
They sing about the difficult times that immigrants go through. I mean, they talk about going to Europe and hoping that things are going to be all easy once they get there. But they talk about how despised immigrants are in Europe, coming from wherever they come from. And these are some of the issues that they talk about.
Is there a song about that we should hear?
Yeah, it's a song called Emigrante. I think it's not a very happy song. I think it's a very angry song about the hard times that immigrants go through once they get to Europe.
And, you know, the lyrics are somewhat different from a lot of rap music, especially music we hear in this country, which can often be sexist or violent.
I think it wouldn't be correct to say that all hip-hop or rap coming out of America is sexist. I think there's also a lot of rap coming out of America that addresses issues. But I think the Orishas, they're really talking about issues that they have to deal with coming from Cuba and also, like the last song that we heard about being immigrants in Europe.
Now, there's another song I'd like to listen to because it really represents the music and dance spirit of Cuba. Can you tell us anything about this song before we play it, Ish?
Represent. Yeah, sure. Represent is, as they would say on the street, they're bigging up Cuba.
What does that mean?
They're praising their home country, and it's about representing the spirit of Cuba with music and dance.
Oh, that's nice. Ish, thanks for talking to us today about the Orishas.
You're most welcome, Peggy. It was a pleasure.
Ish Mafundikwa is our world music tour guide. He spoke to us from his home in Harare, Zimbabwe. Coming up, what do we do in the days before Craigslist, eBay, or even classified ads? Find out a bit later on the World Vision Report. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Diane Toomey, sitting in today for Peggy Waymire. Last month, women took to the streets in Mumbai to protest against scenes of domestic violence in a new Bollywood movie. Domestic violence is all too real in India. The UN estimates that about 70% of married women there experience some form of it. But husbands aren't the only perpetrators. So are fathers, uncles, even sons. So some women are learning, behind closed doors, how to stand up for themselves. From northern India, Peter Aronson reports.
It's an idyllic setting, a mud-walled community center in a little village set amongst lush green fields and a babbling brook, the Himalayan foothills in the distance. There's little indication outside this building of what a small group of village women are doing inside. 15 women, ranging in age from their 20s to their 50s, are taking a class to learn to defend and stand up for themselves. They're dressed in colorful traditional Indian pantsuits with long shirts and matching scarves. The technique they're here to learn is called Wenli Do.
Wenli Do means a women's path of strength. That's women finding ways to stay safe and strong and feel empowered. So it's just not a women's safety workshop.
Divya David trains instructors in Wenli Do, which started in Canada in the 1970s. She says while Wenli Do is about self-defense, it's not a martial art.
This is more about developing confidence, using things that women can learn very easily, knowing that they've never done anything physical before. Things that they can use, if I've learned it today, then I can use it tomorrow. And using whatever strength you already have.
46-year-old Meena Dogra is a student in the class. She says Indian women face lots of violence.
From alcoholics especially, even in your own house, husbands and sons, when they drink and come home, they harass their mothers or wives.
Divya David says domestic abuse here is very common.
I've done a workshop. There were 7 women, and 6 of them had been through violent marriages.
And how typical is that in your classes? Have most of the women been through violence?
Almost all, every time.
The Wenlido class starts by working on women's attitudes.
How to say no and use your voice. How to use your body language to create boundaries.
Anya Desai, an Indian American, is here on a postgraduate fellowship from Oberlin College. She's doing work with women in this community and says violence against women in India is so ingrained, women who reach out for help usually get none.
If your uncle is kind of touching you in a way you don't like and you complain to your mom, she'll shush you up and say, you know, don't say anything, that's your uncle. And he's to be respected, you know.
Desai recently took one of the Wenlido classes. She says a key point of the technique is about learning to avoid acting like a victim through controlling your body language and voice.
You have to look directly at the person and say no, and just not smile. Say it from your belly. And so we would sit there staring at each other, trying to say no like we meant it. And many, many people were laughing and laughing. But over time, it did get better. People started saying no, no, and ended up saying no.
So what do we have to do here? We have to say it.
Back in the classroom, it's time for a role-playing exercise. The instructors show what to do if a man puts his hands on you while sitting next to you at a bus stop, a common occurrence judging by the way the women react, with uncomfortable, knowing laughter. The instructor who's playing the bus stop woman tells the guy, "Keep your hands to yourself," and moves the man's hand, grabbing him by the finger and twisting it back painfully. They teach a few other practical self-defense techniques, but they want to keep them secret. In fact, the whole class is kept hush-hush, says instructor Ravindra Sharma.
Does your husband know about this?
No. 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 He knows I'm working with women and give them some trainings and some empowering them, but he actually didn't know what we are making inside the room.
Sharma says the very idea of women learning to defend themselves could infuriate the men of the community and spur more violence. So the women spread the word quietly to other women. Come and learn how to defend yourselves, but don't tell men about it. Meena Dogra says she's going to tell her daughter, a doctor, to come and take the class.
After taking this class, I've gained confidence that if I find myself in a situation like that again, I can really give it back to the guy.
You're making a fist.
The two women conducting today's workshop have already trained more than 200 women. And they say they've heard some of those students have successfully used these techniques to stand up for themselves. And there are Wenlido groups secretly sprouting up all across India. For the World Vision Report, I'm Peter Aronson in northern India.
Got milk? The villagers of Kaskikot sure do. The people from the small Himalayan village get by on subsistence farming, but milk is a major part of their diet. But it's milk unlike anything you've tasted. Just ask reporter Laura Spiro. For the last 6 years, Laura has made regular visits to Kaskikot. When she's there, she lives with a woman she calls Amma, or mother. In this latest installment of our series, What's Cooking, Laura's going to show us how to churn fermented milk.
Every morning, when life along this mountain ridge is still muted and pastel-colored, Amma gets up before I do and goes outside to milk the buffalo. By the time I roll out of bed, she's already put the fresh milk over a fire in the kitchen. But even after it's boiled, milk only stays good for about a day.
so most of it gets fermented into yogurt. And then, every few days, Amma churns that yogurt into two foods called moi and gyu. That's what we're doing this morning. Amma's getting out a variety of small containers made from mud or wood, each containing milk that's been fermenting for a few days. They're filled with thick, gloppy yogurt. We're going to empty the yogurt out of these containers and into a large wooden barrel that's shaped like an oversized vase. It's called a teko. Amma says that we're going to combine all this yogurt with warm water in the teko. So I say, okay, put it in. I should mention that this curd is so rich and fresh, it will change your idea of yogurt forever. Sometimes, if I'm really lucky, Amma sets aside a little bowl of it for me as a treat. Okay, so now we're going to set up. With the teko full of yogurt and warm water, Amma gets out a long bamboo rod with four paddles at one end. She puts that paddled end into the teko. Then there's a rope coiled around the middle of the rod, which Amma holds by its free ends. And when she pulls back and forth, the rod turns one way and then the other. And its paddles churn the milk into a rumbling froth. Let's ask Amma how long this takes.
You're cutting on the lecture.
A full hour. Slowly the fat from the yogurt will rise and collect on the surface. And this is called
gyu.
Amma says that if you eat gyu, it relieves anything that hurts. Amma stops churning and moves the rod in wide circles. We know we're finished because the gyu has collected around the rod like a floating disc. We'll take the gyu out, and the sour liquid that's left is moi. Amma says moi is full of nutrients. It makes you big and strong. And it's really delicious with popcorn, if you have teeth. So now Amma's using her hands to scoop out the gyu from the teko. And she says that until you place a pinch of gyu in the fire for the gods, you can't eat any of it or drink the moi either. So we move into the kitchen and squat by the pit fire. Amma drops a few globs of pale gyu onto the hot charcoal. And she invokes the gods, pays respect to her ancestors, and asks for protection. All right, now we can drink the moi too. And I admit, the thin, sour drink takes a little getting used to. But in Kaski Coat, it's a delight. And by late afternoon, our neighbor Parvati is sitting on the porch with Amma and me, enjoying the fruit of our earlier labor, as grandchildren run around in the clay yard. Tomorrow, Amma will be up before me again, milking the buffalo, storing boiled milk to make gyu and moi, keeping the household, like she says, big and strong. For the World Vision Report, I'm Laura Spiro in Kaski Coat, Nepal.
To see a photo of a teko, that milk-churning device, go to worldvisionreport.org. Afghanistan has an election coming up on August 20th, and of course the outcome will be covered in newspapers and television. But in rural areas of the country, where much of the population is illiterate, people will hear about the results in a decidedly low-tech way, through the trusted town crier. Ben Arnoldy reports from Afghanistan for the Christian Science Monitor. He came across a town crier in his travels there and spoke with host Peggy Waymire about him.
Good to have you back with us, Ben.
Thanks a lot. My pleasure.
Before we learn more about this guy, the town crier, I want to hear about the town itself. What is it like there, and why do they even need a town crier?
The city of Bamiyan is in central Afghanistan, and it's a fairly small-sized town circled by very tall mountains. And it's actually a very safe part of Afghanistan. It's one of the last places journalists can go outside of Kabul these days. And they need a town crier because Afghanistan's literacy rate is extremely low. The last data I saw off the CIA fact book from 2000 was roughly 25%, a quarter of the people are literate. So advertising in the local newspaper isn't going to get you very far. And there isn't much by way of radio or television either. And so having a town crier that will read off announcements and advertisements and help people find their lost child is extremely useful to these people.
So what does he actually do? Wander up and down the street shouting about advertisements and news and notices and lost children?
Well, people will come to him, and for $4, they can give him a small message written on a piece of paper. And he'll take that, and for 90 minutes, he will walk all along the streets of the bazaar. And he's got a megaphone that he speaks into, and he'll just repeat the message again and again, and sometimes stop and explain to people who have questions exactly what it is he's talking about. That's his job, yeah.
Now, I wish you were a radio reporter because you would have taped this, but you're a newspaper right. reporter, so I might have to have right. you do this for us, Ben. What does he sound like?
Well, of course, he's speaking in Dari, so it's a little hard for me to replicate that end of it, but at least from what my translator was telling me was written on the pieces of paper, and then when we had him go march a little bit and read some of the messages that he's done recently, you know, it usually starts with attention, 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 and then usually there's sort of a preamble, you know, praise be to Allah, the most beneficent, and then there'll be the actual message. It'll be something like, we're asking everyone to gather at such and such a place at, you know, 4 o'clock, be there, thank you so much. You know, it's that kind of thing. It isn't necessarily all that poetic. It's very mundane. Yeah.
And it's not news. It sounds like it's more advertising than news.
Well, it's a little of both. It's announcements that locals want to get out there. If somebody's lost something like a wallet or a child or a goat, and then other times we've got sweaters from London for sale. So it runs the gamut. When the Taliban fell, I asked him, so did you announce that? And he said, yes. I walked around and I said to people, it's safe to come back. It's safe to come out. They've left.
What have you heard him crying about?
Well, we asked him to show us some of the messages that he's read over the years, and he has them all bundled up in a pink plastic bag, everything he's ever read since before the Taliban even ruled Afghanistan. So many, many years of these messages. In fact, it would probably be a sociologist's sort of treasure trove to go through that. But some of the ones we saw, there was announcement what the correct price of red meat should be in the market, because I guess they were having some trouble with sellers trying to charge too much. There was announcements congratulating the first Afghan Olympic medalist. He actually has a nickname. No one really calls him by his real name. Everyone calls him Londani. And I said, how did you get that nickname? And he said, oh, when I first started this job, there were a bunch of items that were on sale from London. I think it was clothing of some sort. And the people were so interested hearing about these items for sale in central Afghanistan from London that they ended up calling him Londani. And he told me, I brought London to Afghanistan.
So he's been doing this since before the Taliban.
Yeah, yeah. Something on the order of 20 years.
I'm trying to get a feel for how the people in the town react. Do they count on him? Do they wait for him? Or is it kind of a quaint, fun thing? How much do they depend on Londani?
Well, it's funny. I, in first hearing about this and as he's explaining it, I'm thinking to myself, I'm not sure I'd want to hear somebody with a megaphone for 90 minutes you know, giving me advertisements. I guess that's sort of the Western sort of opinion about being saturated with advertising. But there, when I talked to other people in the market, they said, oh, no, we love Londani. He gives us information, and it's very hard to get information in Afghanistan. And so he's a sort of a credible source, and he's got a very nice voice. Everyone complimented him on his voice, something that he's very proud of, too. He's not shy about saying, I have an excellent voice.
Well, maybe one day somebody will discover that little plastic bag of everything he's ever been commissioned to read, and they'll publish a book or make him famous.
I hope so. Yeah, that'd be great for him.
All right, Ben, thanks for that story, and we'll be back in touch with you.
Sure. Thank you.
Ben Arnoldy is a reporter for the Christian Science Monitor. And that's it for this week. Become a fan of the World Vision Report on Facebook and go to our website, worldvisionreport.org, to read blogs from our reporters around the world. And while you're there, you can let us know what you think about the show. We're always interested in feedback. The program is produced by Beverly Abel. Lita Hartman is the assignment editor. Christina Darden, Cynthia Graber, and Sue Shepherd are our producers. Doug Boyles and Mark Bandy are our audio engineers. Our interactive editor is Larry Short. And I'm Diane Toomey. Thanks for listening.
This program is produced with funding from World Vision. The views expressed in this show are not necessarily those of the organization.